All right. Well, welcome everyone. Especially, we picked up a couple of new students. I know this is just temporary here. So, and what I talked to Michael. I said, what I'll do, since we heard there may be four or five people, I'm going to do about a 15, because that's half. At least 10, 12 minute review of what we did Sunday to try to catch everybody up, explain what this class is all about, and talk about what our objectives are for the class. And I think everybody has to go. So let me, of course, this is the Case for Christ class. Based off of some of the material is based off of some of the material in the book I gathered. I cannibalized some material that was online someone else had made, and I'll show you from different resources to kind of put this together. This is the first of this class, as I said, so the next group, I guess if Parker and I teach again, we're going to clean it up some more after we get probably some feedback from you guys, see if there's some more things we needed to talk about more than what's in here, condense it a little bit better than the things that's just kind of put together right now. So this material is adapted from these kind of places like the Case of Christ, the Course of Christian Witness, Christian Apologetics, Mark Copeland, of course the book, there's a study guide, and a lot of material, How We Got the Bible, Danny Haynes, Journey Through Bible Archaeology, Danny Haynes. There's some things on our own website that people have taught about evidences that we use some of that information in here as well. So. We changed, the reason why I gave you that extra sheet, we had a different setup, I think it was from here down, and so we kind of renamed, we renamed our classes, but in your packet they still look the same, so I just let you know on page 26 now in your packet, that's now Jesus on the witness stand, we have one, two, and it should say three, there shouldn't be two and three, but it should say three. A lot of information about putting Jesus on the witness stand, and we'll explain about why that's important. And so as you can see, this is what we have, kind of our outline for the class. The review, and I'll mention this again, what we hope to do is get some questions and some comment. Matter of fact, our class today, I guess towards the end, talks about, hey, if you have some questions, some doubts or just some things you've already had, well, let's write those down. You can either email them or send it. We're going to make that our review, see if some of these things that we talked about, can we in our time here find some biblical answers for some of the things that may have caused doubt, or and see if we can answer some of these things. So that's what the review class is basically about. Again, that's an outline of the book. So our goals here, to examine critically, honestly, the claims of New Testament Christianity, learn how to respond to skeptics and defend the faith, to gain knowledge to support one's own ability to choose faith, to engage the gospel in a way based on courtroom drama. Like I said, this information was, some of it that was taken, they did kind of make it like a courtroom drama. We're not going to read through a lot of that, but as you read it, it's, you know, there's... They kind of set it up like that, so and you'll see as we go through some of these. So our objective is here. You know, we're going to discuss some of the evidences in the Case for Christ book to respond positively. Typical criticism, argument against the Christian faith, to identify and articulate the main reasons we have Christian faith, to choose or to know for themselves the Christian faith on an informed basis. And we're going to talk about strengthening our faith in Jesus Christ, and hope the conclusion of all of this. With the basis in mind, we shall endeavor to give evidence that warrant faith in Jesus of Nazareth. We shall not attempt to prove anything beyond a shadow of doubt, for that is not possible. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But we shall try to show that it's more logical to believe in Jesus than not to. So we start out the class just saying, what is apologetic? And I think Jonathan mentioned this defense as a doctrine, a branch of theology devoted to the defense of divine origin or the authority of Christianity. That's, some of that is what we're going to do, but that's not actually what this class is really about. In 1 Peter 3:15, Peter says, all Christians are commanded to be ready to make a defense for the reason for the hope that's in Christ. That word defense, where we get our word apology from, when you see the word defense, that's that word. I think it's like 8 times it's used in the New Testament. Paul uses it in Acts when he's defending, when they said, hey, you were in the temple wrong, and he wanted to talk and say, no, he wants to defend his feet. And 1 Corinthians 9:3, he was defending himself as an apostle, but that's not how Peter's using it. Peter uses this word in the context of an informal inquiry by a friend or a neighbor asking, why are you a Christian? So that's different than, why are you a Christian? So that means when someone turns the flashlight on you, you have to think about, why do I go to worship? Why do I actually believe these things? So there has to be some information in your head and your heart so you can feel confident when you tell someone. I mean, I think this is what happens a lot of times. We're not really confident about why we believe, and there's reasons for that, especially if you may have grown up in a home. This is what you were taught. And you really sometimes didn't go in and investigate for yourself and for why you believe these things. And so if you're ever asked, you know, I have some doubts or some concerns, then your faith may waver because you really can't answer why. And a lot of people have come, have run into that situation. So in doing so, we hope to accomplish these two objectives, as I said, to strengthen our faith in Jesus Christ and to help prepare ourselves to be able to do the very thing enjoyed by Peter, to give someone an answer for what we believe. the way we kind of broke this down from an apologetics standpoint, that a Christian's faith is an intelligent, rational faith, it's a historical, factual faith, it's an objective faith, and it's based on principles of truth. And then we say, well, if that's all true, then why do people still reject the Christ, if that's the case? So we said that it's intelligent and rational because it appeals to the mind as well as the heart. And we say God expects us to use our mind. We use this text on Sunday where the Lord said, you should love the Lord thy God with all your heart, soul, and with your mind. So it's just not something about feelings. God is expecting us to investigate, use our hearts and minds. And when we do, when we're committed in this way, then this information is anchored and rooted in us. It's just not something that you feel. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to mention a couple places where it is based, some people's belief is just based on a subjective feeling about things and really not grounded in these kind of things. But God expects us this evidence for us to be intelligent. We're not supposed to just commit intellectual suicide. And that's where some critics would say that we throw off everything. We're just dumb. And we can just believe this stuff, that we're not really intelligent and everything else. And there's nothing in the scriptures that would suggest that. God actually does not want us to commit intellectual suicide in order to have faith. This quote for here says, it's important that as one person says, my heart cannot rejoice in what my mind rejects. A weak faith may be the result of a heart trying to believe in something the mind cannot accept. But a strong faith requires involvement with both the mind and the heart. So it is important that we present reason why we believe in an intelligent and rational matter. But we're not going to pander to man's intellectual arrogance. But we must cater to the intelligent integrity. So we talked about what I mentioned earlier about, but this means we can't offer 100% proof, which for some people, they may be disturbed, saying, well, you can't prove something 100%. Well, why are you following it? Well, then the question would be, what can we all prove with anything that we do 100%?
What I was going to say, then that's where your faith comes in. You have to take that leap. You can do almost all what you can, you know, with the evidences and so forth and studying, and then take that leap into That's where our faith, and he needs for us to have faith.
And the next couple of lines is going to follow what you said. But you think about it. Is there anything we can be 100% sure of? Like 100%?
Not many.
So I was thinking about who are, you know, this is kind of a thing to say, who was our parents? I mean, there are shows where people have grown up 30 years old and find out that dad is not dad or mom's not mom. I had no idea. But, you know, there's nothing we can do. But yet we often make 100% commitments with less than 100%, like flying an airplane. You know, I gave some stats about, you know, we get in a car and it's more likely we'll be killed in a car accident than actually flying in the airplane. But no one, when they get in the plane, just expect to get there. Are you 100% sure you're going to make it to your destination? I don't think anyone says, I'm not going to get in this plane and get there unless I'm 100% sure. No one does that. But based off the evidence and statistics about safe and these things, people do it. But we would hardly do anything if we needed 100% proof that something works or does. I mean, we get in the car in Atlanta. You know, we say, Lord willing, it is serious. We say, Lord willing, I'll see you next week. I mean, but we cannot be 100% certain that we'll have a safe journey. But this statistics, evidence is strong enough to convince where we are. And what you were talking about, let's see. Okay. Is there enough evidence or proof to warrant making 100% commitment to Christ? So we believe that there is certain enough evidence to commit myself 100% to him rather than be 100% against them. And the alternative that Jesus mentioned here, he gives us, there's only two. It's either you're either for him or against them. There's really no. Jesus is like an airplane. Either we get on board totally or we get left about. He provides, as we're going to talk about, he provides evidence that we can then, as you say, I know it's not a, I know we say a leap of faith, but he provides evidence. If he's this, if he's provided this, then I can trust these things that obviously that are out of my control or that I can't see.
The gap.
Yes. He provides those things. Yes. We're going to talk about the evidence. It's an objective faith. The faith is in who he was, the Christ, the Son of God, and what he did. He rose from the dead on the third day. And it does make a difference what we believe. These two quotes down there from John 8:24 and Romans 10:9. This faith is not in, note that this faith is not in itself that is important, but it's in whom the object of our faith is based on. And I'm sure these two quotes are familiar to both of you, to most of us in this class. You know, when you make a confession with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, you're making a declaration to people that you believe something. And if you do that, the word's not pressure. But what does this invite when you confess?
Accountability.
Yes. Accountability. So your accountability. People are going to, if you do this, you know, this is kind of the first Peter. So you believe this, you confess this. Well, why do you believe this?
James, I have an example.
Yeah, go ahead.
I heard someone say one time, you know, if I went on a diet and I just to myself just said I'm going to go on a diet and no one else knew about it, I'm more likely to cheat. If I came out and told my whole family, yeah, I'm going on a diet and all my friends, that nice piece of chocolate cake, I might be more willing to, like, not eat that because I made this public commitment that I'm going on a diet, mm-hmm. as if I just kept it in my inside of myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It'd be different.
I like that. I'll use that someday. So, I don't like chocolate cake, though.
We can still be friends.
We can still be friends, okay. the Christian faith is historical, factual faith. I didn't say this the last time, but as I was going through these notes, so my son Donovan, when he was at Norcross and they were studying, I think it was the Middle East, he would bring his Bible. He had his Bible, but he'd bring it to class on purpose when they talked about history. And he was using his Bible to answer some of the history questions. And people were shocked. They're like, why is that in there? There are people don't think the Bible is a historical book, a book of history. They really think, for most people, think it's just somebody put something together and everything else. But the fact that he could go in there and talk about some Middle East things and use the scriptures to talk about this, they were just, the students were just in awe that you can do that. So again, misinformation, we're going to talk about that. But again, it is the fact, backing Christians claim it's not a special kind of religious facts. There's some groups that have their special kind of religious facts. But this is based on history. Yes, there it is. So Luke 2, 1, let's see, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 5 or 3 through, I think I put 1 and 5 there. Yeah, 1 and 5. So when Luke starts off the book of Luke, look what he does when he writes to Theophilus. Said in these days, a decree went out, Caesar Augustus, to all the world should be registered. This was the registration with Quirinius was governor of Syria. And they all went to be registered, each to their own town. And Joseph went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, Judah, city of David, called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, and his child. Is this a smart thing to do? Look what Luke is inviting. In those days, the decree went out, and he's mentioning people's name. If this is not real history, won't you be able to Google this real quick and find out that either this guy never existed, or he never was in the part of this world, or there was no such thing as some registration going out in the world in this time frame? Even though a lot of people reject the scriptures, they talk about Luke as he is one of the finest historians that's ever been produced, because he's so accurate and detailed in a lot of these things. You don't put things out like this where people can actually check things out. You would do like we Star Wars in the far, far away, something like that. So something that's just ambiguous that you can't. You don't put names where people can do and then come up and say, "Well, that person." Now that doesn't say that you're going to find every single name that's mentioned in the script. But when you're talking about people in government and those things, especially since Rome was they were the world power at that time, you should be able to find some interest. You should be able to find people, where they ruled, what was their position, those things like that. That would have been the first key that Luke was wrong in there. But his appeal to time, places, and peoples and events is actually exists in history. Getting run out of batteries. Okay. The Christian faith, therefore, is a historical faith that appeals to certain facts and historical occurrences, not a philosophy. I know I wouldn't have read this. The first one, where faith appealing to philosophies of men, not a faith that's based upon myths and legends. And then, okay, yes. Based on truth, and truth is always open to be examined. So, these two here. Parker mentioned this Sunday, and we'll see this. Acts 2:20-22, men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth is a man tested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs. God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. For those that were not here or even here, when Peter said this, where were they when he said this? You remember what city, town, where was he when he said this?
Jerusalem.
He was in Jerusalem. Where was Jesus killed?
Basically Jerusalem.
Okay. So, if you were making something up, would you say something like this and try to talk to people in the city where people know what happened? Would you go like far, far away, like some people that run hoaxes and they make up stuff? You don't do this in the same city where people could say, that's not true. Matter of fact, it was 50 days later. By that time, somebody could have brought up a body and said, "Here's this guy, what are you talking about?" But none of that ever happened. In the same city to where they killed him, people know about what's going on. And that's the point Paul makes here. When he's talking to Festus as a king, when he was talking about the gospel and talking about Jesus, verse 26, "For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly, for I am persuaded that none of the things has escaped his notice. For this has not been done in a corner. This is not some secret thing that people did about Jesus raising from the dead, all this other stuff. This, people know about this. People are talking about this. And as the king, he would have that, that information would be coming to him. And of course, the king said, you persuaded me to be a Christian. You're trying to give me this evidence to make me make a decision about things. So he's actually, Paul is talking about why he believes. He's going to present some evidence, so he's hoping somebody else will believe, but this is the same evidence for Paul himself. Of course, he got to see the risen Lord, but still, that's a little bit extra to this. So what I was going to say, and I want to make sure, I'm not trying to pick on Jehovah's Witness or Mormons, but the Christian faith is open to honest examination. It's just not one of the things that we have, I think, in part 1, 2, and 3 about Jesus on the witness stand. These two groups, what they believe about Jesus is different than what the Scripture says about Jesus. So we have to look at the evidence and say, wherever the evidence points us, does it point us to the Jesus of the Jehovah's Witness, or the Jesus of the Mormons, or is he just the Jesus of the Scriptures? And actually, we let the evidence point us to where we are. And again, not trying to pick on anyone else or anything else. Matter of fact, particularly with the Mormons that I've had years of study with, when you talk about open examination of a particular thing, what they will tell me is that they received a confirmation of a burning in their breast, even though the information that they believe is not accurate, they can't be verified. They said, well, I have this confirmation. Well, that's not how truth is, truth is established. It's not by a feeling, because that's subjective. Anybody can do, you can't, truth is not subjective. And so, and it's always open, like I said, if there's truth there, of course, there's falsehood. So, that is open to be proven wrong. To illustrate, you don't have to believe Jesus was raised from the dead. Use the evidence that's available and then attempt to prove that he wasn't. So, how do we prove, how do you think you could prove that, without using the word resurrection, because some skeptics would say the resurrection is a miracle. You can't prove a miracle because it's outside the way our world works. Well, what can you prove that, without using the word resurrection? What two things do you need to prove that Jesus was resurrected without mentioning the word resurrection?
The tomb was empty.
Okay, tomb was empty. And so before the tomb was empty, Jesus was alive, right? He was alive. And then what is the second thing you need? You got empty tomb, then what else?
Resurrection.
Well, I would assume that he was killed in the first place.
Yes.
I
don't know. You killed in the first place, and then you said, you see, people saw him afterwards. So, alive, dead, I see him alive again. I don't even have to mention resurrection. But if I can show that people saw him alive, saw him killed, and then saw him alive, that's a resurrection. So I don't need to, as a skeptic, would say, oh, you got, no. Do I have proof that people saw Jesus alive? Do I have proof that people killed you and he was really dead? We're going to talk about the swoon theory where people said he came this close to death. I mean, just that close to death. And the nice, cool tomb kind of revived him, and he was able to show himself to people, and they saw him alive after that. But anybody that knows about Romans and what they did, they were very good at it. The accountability they had on their own lives with prisoners escape or they didn't carry out their task, you would know that, you know, when someone's dead, and when it rubs it, they make sure you're dead. But again, let the evidence show you those things. So, let's see. So I can make sure I get on my... So, we looked at those four quick things. I'm sorry, again, it's a quick review. So, if... I know I laid it out pretty easy, but then why do people still reject Christ? Usually one of three reasons. Ignorance. In John 7:40 and 43, people rejected Jesus because they were ignorant of the historical facts concerning his birth. Someone read John 21. I thought about this. This is not in your book, but I was actually watching a movie, The Book of John, today. Actually pretty good on Netflix today. And this caught my my ear towards the end. Someone read verses 20 through 23 of John chapter 21. Whoever gets there first, then that.
Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "The Lord, what about this man?" And Jesus said to him, "If I will, or if I will that he remain till I come, what is it to you? You follow me." Then saying this, went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. And Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but "If I will that he remain till I come, what is it? What is that to you?"
So in John 7:40-43, it was ignorance about the historical facts concerning his birth. What other thing could throw people off what we just read? What other thing could, just because people are ignorant, misunderstood, what could possibly happen? Who did they think? It started going around, and who did they thought would never die?
Peter.
John. What if John dies? And this thing's been spreading around and John dies. Now what do they think about Jesus? False prophet. He said John would never die. And he never said that. It's just people just hearing something. And he told them that's not what happened. He said, "Oh no, they spread this. It went around." A lot of misinformation. We talked about YouTube videos. Oh my word. Christianity destroyed in 5 minutes. I mean, just all of these things like that. And, you know, and so people just can be destroyed. And so ignorance is a lot of times where people don't, they lack the accurate information. Pride has always been those things. I think John 12:42-43, I think that's the one about the leaders did not accept it. Yes. John 12:41-43, yes. It said, "Nevertheless, many, even the authorities, believed in him, but of fear of the Pharisees did not confess it, so they would not be put out of the synagogue, for they love the glory that comes from men more than the glory that comes from God." So, pride, rejected. There's a good friend of mine, thought she was going to obey the gospel, but she loved her mother too much. She knew this would cause a strain in her relationship with her mother. And to this day, she has not. She's still alive, but again, there's other things that will keep want to be approved by men. And then, of course, there's always the moral problem. Some people reject the evidence because it means having to change their lifestyle. Today, many people put the efforts to justify their immorality, accepting only the evidence that supports theories that allow them to continue the lifestyle. Everybody loves the Jesus of love. Everybody loves the Jesus of forgiveness. But then when it says, but the Jesus that demands as a king, as the Lord of your life, that you behave a certain way, we don't want that Jesus. And that's where people kind of pick and choose the Jesus they want. So they reject any evidence which may support a doctrine that would condemn their behavior and require them to change. And so it often points out this. The rejection of Christ is not much a problem of the mind, but of the will. It's not much "I can't, but I won't." There is enough evidence to convict an honest seeking heart. So Frank Turk, He wrote the book, I think his first book, "I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist." Have you ever seen him debate or go on the college campus and some student or anyone would, you know, they talk about this evidence there. He would ask them a question. He said, and I looked, he would ask them this question: "If Christianity was true, would you accept it?" He would ask them, they said, "Okay, I know you're telling me, but if it was true," no one says yes. He's saying, if it's true, you know it's true, and you're still not going to accept it? So this has nothing to do with evidence. This has to do with the will. I don't want to bow. I want to rule my own life. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, if someone says, beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's true, and you're still not going to accept it, it means I want to live my life the way I want to. And that's what a lot of times it comes down to. Yeah, it's some of these things, but it comes down to this. I want to be king of my own life. I want to do my own thing. And God loves us enough to say, I'll let you do that. One of the things I want to make sure I've mentioned is that he gave us the greatest gift, and it's almost the greatest curse at the same time. He gave us free will. Everything else in God's creation does exactly what it's supposed to do. Behaves exactly where it's supposed to. Except for us. It's made in His image. We're the only things that tell Him no. And He breaks His heart, but He accepts that. And so we have to accept the consequences that goes along with that. So that's that was the quick, as quick as could. I'm sorry that sounded like a lecture, but please, anytime you guys stop, ask questions, point out, maybe go over something. Anytime. So now we're going to look at Christ on trial. If you've kind of looked at the material, it almost sounds like some of the things in there is talking about the like some of the apologetics that we kind of look at some of the points. You'll see them repeated in here, but we actually have a class. We're going to divide you up into two, so you guys are going to read something and come back and we're going to talk about it. But I want you to think about these questions here as we look at Lazarus and not Lazarus, Zacharias, and Mary when we look at their stories. Do you think it's all right to ask questions about faith? What does it mean to be a skeptic? What does it mean to question authority? And what does it mean to have doubt? And since we've been talking about a trial, in the context of trial, what would this produce? What would produce this feeling if you have doubt? And so we're gonna talk about this. So, let me see. You're right in the middle.
No.
So Luke, this way. Why don't you guys read Zechariah's story? And I think his is Luke 1:5-25. Is his the first one, or is it Mary?
I think it's also in the book.
Oh, it's in the book. Yeah, yeah.
It's in the material.
It's in the material. Yes, and then the other side, Elizabeth. I said Mary.
Page 9.
Yeah. So you guys, as a group, talk together, and then I want you to, just not reading out loud. Look at things that are similar. Of course, notice the highlights in bold. How are they different? Do the outcomes differ? What are some reasons that they might explain why the outcomes are different? And what is wrong for either of them to question the angel of the Lord? So, as a group, kind of look at this answer. And this is Zechariah. This is Mary. Why did I say?
It is Mary.
Yeah. It says Elizabeth.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know how they get that.
That's called a typo.
That's a big typo. Well, at least it's spelled correctly.
I mean, the first story could technically be Zechariah and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And the second one, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because Elizabeth was the one that was pregnant. Right?
Yeah. So, this is a group.
Yeah.
So, Luke,
turn and talk. You need a pen.
None of these have.
Oh wait, no.
None of them are.
I'll give you 3 minutes, because you know the story. Look at time. I burned up a lot of time. I was so proud of myself that I finished. So how? What are the look at the similarities. How are they different? Do the outcomes differ? And what are some explanations why there was a different outcome? And was it wrong for either of them to question the angel of the Lord?
Yeah.
Alrighty. Because I burned up too much time in my review. You guys can still figure out. So, what are the similarities between what happened with Zechariah and happened to Mary?
They both had almost identical responses.
Okay, to the angel.
Yes.
They both had an angel appear to them.
Okay, both had an angel appear to them. Okay. And what was what was her response?
Her response was, "How can this be, since I do not know man?" His was, "How shall I know this, for I'm an old man?"
Okay, from the question.
So the initial response is they were both scared.
They were both scared. Mm-hmm. So angel Lord, they're both scared. All right. So
and they both provide words of comfort.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Don't
the
be afraid.
Angel provides. The
don't be afraid. Okay.
Those people ask how.
Well, people ask how.
And then they give some kind of evidence right after that, like how, like, I'm an old man, like, that doesn't seem like it happened to me yet. And then Mary says, like, you know, I haven't even been with the man. And, you know, it's like immediately they give, like, a wife wouldn't have it.
So, Why do you think the outcome was different? They both asked how to do something. Here's an old man about to have a, saying your wife's going to have a baby. And here's a virgin. He says, you're about to have a baby. Why would why do you think the outcomes were different?
I would say the outcomes were different because Mary had a logical reason to ask that question of like how it was going to happen. Zechariah didn't. One of the things we were talking about is he was a priest. You know, and even praying for something like that to happen, he shouldn't be like, why is this happening? He should be rejoicing. He should be excited. He should be, you know, jumping for joy, you know, thanking God that he's blessed him with this instead of asking him, well, how is it possible? He should already know how it's possible.
Was it wrong for either of them to question the angel of the Lord?
I would say it was wrong for him. Because he should already know.
So asking the question is now what gets Zechariah in trouble. If asking the question was wrong, then wouldn't the Virgin Mary likewise deserve to be punished? Is God partial, unfair? So what is the difference between the two questions?
Belief, for sure.
Yeah. Zechariah's question, how shall I know this? For I'm an old man and my wife is well advanced in years. He's basically saying, how am I expected to believe this? He is, of all people, should be aware that God, as you said, can do all things. He had no excuse for his unbelief. His question was rhetoric, not genuine. Thus, his question is not rewarded, and he is unable to respond to the angel or anyone else. That's what, how can I do this since I do not know a man? Is a legitimate question. She's not asking how is it possible for her to believe, but believing how... She asks, how will it actually take place? Because she is receptive to the new knowledge and does not assume she knows it all. Thus, her question is rewarded, and she is able to respond firmly to God's will. This is about God wants us to ask questions, but I was thinking about other people that, I wouldn't say question God, but ask for more information. Ask for something. I was thinking about Gideon. And he was really patient with Gideon. I mean, he said, okay, let me try it this way, let me try it that way. But when it comes to, I think with Zechariah, the respect or the respect he should have had for the Lord, he did not, it was rejected by God. He was not rewarded. He was rewarded being mute for 9 months until John was born. And I know the second bell. So, what I need you guys to do, if you don't do it today, when you bring it out there, start writing down some questions and some things about doubts and whether you know someone else has had these questions. It doesn't have to be yours. But we want to develop some, have some things ready for our review class. Where you go ahead.
So I think it's extremely important to ask questions. I think it's also extremely important to try and find answers to those questions.
Yeah.
Because far too often we want to ask a question maybe to be antagonistic to some degree, or to just kind of be in this, maybe to settle with ignorance,
yeah.
To be okay with ignorance. Like, well, here's this question. It's a really hard question to answer, so
yeah.
I'm just going to move on. Yeah. But to actually want to know an answer. And in teaching, so many times kids are questioned, you know, why do we have to wear a uniform? Why do we have to have homework? Do you really want an answer to that? Are
right.
you actually curious,
yeah.
or are you just complaining? Yeah. I think a lot of times we ask these questions with no real intention of finding the answer. But if we're going to ask questions, especially something as serious as this,
mm-hmm.
we better be willing to put in the work to find the answers yeah. to do that.
You make a great point. I started to write these down, but over and over, when people would ask Jesus a question, they usually would say they did this to test him, or they really didn't want to know. They were just trying to stump him. And so Jesus already knew it. You're not asking from a sincere heart. You don't want to know the answer. You're like, your man, wife dies and then marries seven brothers. Then which one? He said, you're not even serious about this question. So like I said, you develop this great, crazy question and trying to get some response. But you're at the heart of it. You're just trying to trip somebody up or stump them. And that's what comes a lot of times. But the serious thing is, as you said, if you're serious, God has provided evidence. And he wants us to have this evidence so we can be sure for ourselves. And when you're confident in what you believe, you're better to express it. You look for opportunities to express it. And you'll live like the confession you made. I mean, if you really kind of, like you said, you don't really believe this. It's hard to be, to profess, like you said, to say this. And then the obstacles and the temptations to avoid. You'll be a lot more if you actually believe the things about God and Christ in Scripture. So, all right. Thanks, guys. Thank you for letting me go over the review again. And we will see you Sunday. Lord.